but none that I know have seen them. What are they like? Arlen asked.
Fort Angiers, the forest stronghold, lies south of Milne across the dividing river, Reagan said. Angiers supplies wood for the other cities. Farther south lies the Great Lake, and on its surface stands Lacton.
Is a lake like a pond? Arlen asked.
A lake is to a pond what a mountain is to a hill, Reagan said, giving Arlen a moment to digest the thought. Out on the water, the Lactonians are safe from flame, rock, and wood demons. Their ward net is proof against wind demons, and no people can ward against water demons better. They're fisher folk, and thousands in the southern cities depend on their catch for food. West of Lacton is Fort Risen, which isn't technically a fort, since you could practically step over its wall, but it shields the largest farmlands you've ever seen. Without Risen, the other free cities would starve.
And Crasia? Arlen asked.
I only visited Fort Crasia once, Reagan said. The Crasians aren't welcoming to outsiders, and you need to cross weeks of desert to get there.
Desert?
Sand, Reagan explained. Nothing but sand for miles in every direction. No food nor water but what you carry, and nothing to shade you from the scorching sun.
And people live there? Arlen asked.
Oh, yes, Reagan said. The Crasians used to be even more numerous than the Milnese, but they're dying off.
Why?
Arlen asked. Because they fight the Korlings, Reagan said. Arlen's eyes widened.
You can fight Korlings? He asked.
You can fight anything, Arlen, Reagan said. The problem with fighting Korlings is that more often than not, you lose. The Crasians kill their share, but the Korlings give better than they get. There are fewer Crasians every year.
My Da says Korlings eat your soul when they get you, Arlen said.
Bah! Reagan spat over the side of the cart. Superstitious nonsense. They had turned a bend not far from the cluster when Arlen noticed something dangling from the tree ahead of them.
What's that? He asked, pointing.
Night, Reagan swore, and he cracked the reins, sending the mollies into a gallop. Arlen was thrown back in his seat and took a moment to right himself. When he did, he looked at the tree, which was coming up fast.
Uncle Charlie,
he cried, seeing the man kicking as he clawed at the rope around his neck.
Help! Help!
Arlen screamed. He leapt from the moving cart, hitting the ground hard, but he bounced to his feet, darting toward Charlie. He got up under the man, but one of Charlie's thrashing feet kicked him in the mouth, knocking him down. He tasted blood, but strangely there was no pain. He came up again, grabbing Charlie's legs and trying to lift him up to loosen the rope, but he was too short, and Charlie too heavy besides, and the man continued to gag and jerk.
"Help him!" Arlen cried to Reagan. "He's choking! Somebody help!"
He looked up to see Reagan pull a spear from the back of the cart. The messenger drew back and threw with hardly a moment to aim, but his aim was true, severing the rope and collapsing poor Charlie onto Arlen. They both fell into the dirt. Reagan was there in an instant, pulling the rope from Charlie's throat. It didn't seem to make much difference. The man still gagged and clawed at his throat. His eyes bulged so far it looked as if they would pop right out of his head, and his face was so red it looked purple. Arlen screamed as he gave a tremendous thrash, and then lay still. Reagan beat Charlie's chest and breathed huge gulps of air into him, but it had no effect. Eventually the messenger gave up, slumping in the dirt and cursing. Arlen was no stranger to death. That specter was a frequent visitor to Tibbetts Brook, but it was one thing to die from the Korlings or from a chill. This was different.
Why? He asked Reagan. Why would he fight so hard to survive last night, only to kill himself now?
Did he fight? Reagan asked. Did any of them really fight? Or did they run and hide?
I don't...
Arlen began. Hiding isn't always enough, Arlen, Reagan said. Sometimes hiding kills something inside of you, so that even if you survive the demons, you don't, really. What else could he have done? Arlen asked. You can't fight a demon.
I'd sooner fight a bear in its own cave, Reagan said. But it can be done.
But you said the Krasians were dying because of it, Arlen protested.
They are, Reagan said. But they follow their hearts. I know it sounds like madness, Arlen, but deep down men want to fight, like they did in tales of old. They want to protect their women and children as men should. But they can't, because the great wards are lost, so they knot themselves like caged hares, hiding terrified through the night. But sometimes, especially when you see loved ones die, the tension breaks you, and you just snap. He put a hand on Arlen's shoulder. I'm sorry you had to see this, boy, he said. I know it doesn't make a lot of sense right now.
No, Arlen said. It does.
And it was true, Arlen realized. He understood the need to fight. He hadn't expected to win when he attacked Kobe and his friends that day. If anything, he had expected to be beaten worse than ever. But in that instant when he grabbed the stick, he hadn't cared. He only knew he was tired of just taking their abuse and wanted it to end, one way or another. It was comforting to know he wasn't alone. Arlen looked at his uncle lying in the dirt, his eyes wide with fear. He knelt and reached out, brushing his eyes closed with his fingertips. Charlie had nothing to fear any longer.
"Have you ever killed a Korling?" he asked the messenger.
"No," Reagan said, shaking his head. "But I've fought a few, got the scars to prove it. But I was always more interested in getting away, or keeping them away from someone else than I was in killing any." Arlen thought about that as they wrapped Charlie in a tarp and put him in the back of the wagon, hurrying back to the cluster. Jeff and Sylvie had already packed the cart and were waiting impatiently to leave, but the sight of the body diffused their anger at Arlen's late return. Sylvie wailed and threw herself on her brother, but there was no time to waste if they were to make it back to the farm by nightfall. Jeff had to hold her back as Tender Harold painted a ward on the tarp and led a prayer as he tossed Charlie into the pyre. The survivors who weren't staying in Brian Cutter's house were divided up and taken home with the others. Jeff and Sylvie had offered succor to two women. Noreen Cutter was over 50 summers old. Her husband had died some years back, and she had lost her daughter and grandson in the attack. Maria Bales was old too, almost 40. Her husband had been left outside when the others drew lots for the cellar. Like Sylvie, both slumped in the back of Jeff's cart, staring at their knees. Arlen waved goodbye to Reagan as his father cracked the whip. The cluster by the woods was drawing out of sight when Arlen realized he hadn't told anyone to come see the jongleur. Chapter 2 If It Was You 319 AR They had just enough time to stow the cart and check the wards before the Korlings came. Sylvie had little energy for cooking, so they ate a cold meal of bread, cheese, and sausage, chewing with little enthusiasm. The demons came soon after sunset to test the wards, and every time the magic flared to throw them back, Noreen cried out. Maria never touched her food. She sat on her pallet with her arms wrapped tightly around her legs, rocking back and forth and whimpering whenever the magic flared. Sylvie cleared the plates, but she never returned from the kitchen, and Arlen could hear her crying. Arlen tried to go to her, but Jeff caught his arm. "Come talk with me, Arlen," he said. They went into the small room that housed Arlen's pallet, his collection of smooth rocks from the brook, and all his feathers and bones. Jeff selected one of these, a brightly colored feather about 10 inches long, and fingered it as he spoke, not looking Arlen in the eye. Arlen knew the signs. When his father wouldn't look at him, it meant he was uncomfortable with whatever he wanted to talk about. "What you saw on the road with the messenger?" Jeff began.
"Reagan explained it to me," Arlen said. Uncle Charlie was dead already. He just didn't know it right away. Sometimes people live through an attack, but die anyway.
Jeff frowned. Not how I would have put it, he said, but true enough, I suppose.
Charlie was a coward, Arlen finished. Jeff looked at him in surprise.
What makes you say that? He asked.
He hid in the cellar because he was scared to die, and then killed himself because he was scared to live, Arlen said. Better if he had just picked up an axe and died fighting.
I don't want to hear that kind of talk, Jeff said. You can't fight demons, Arlen. No one can. There's nothing to be gained by getting yourself killed.
Arlen shook his head. They're like bullies, he said. They attack us because we're too scared to fight back. I hit Kobe and the others with that stick, and they didn't bother me again.
Kobe and a rock demon, Jeff said. No stick is going to scare those off.
There's got to be a way, Arlen said. People used to do it. All the old stories say so.
The stories say there were magic wards to fight with, Jeff said. The fighting wards are lost.
Reagan says they still fight demons in some places. He says it can be done.
I'm going to have a talk with that messenger, Jeff grumbled. He shouldn't be filling your head with such thoughts.
Why not? Arlen said. Maybe more people would have survived last night if all the men had gotten axes and spears.
They would be just as dead, Jeff finished. There's other ways to protect yourself and your family, Arlen. Wisdom, prudence, humility. It's not brave to fight a battle you can't win. Who would care for the women and the children if all the men got themselves cored trying to kill what can't be killed? He went on. Who would chop the wood and build the homes? Who'd hunt and herd and plant and slaughter? Who would seed the women with children? If all the men die, the Corlings win.
The Corlings are already winning, Marlin muttered. You keep saying the town gets smaller each year. Bullies keep coming when you don't fight back.
He looked up at his father.
Don't you feel it? Don't you want to fight sometimes?
Of course I do, Arlen, Jeff said. But not for no reason. When it matters, when it really matters, all men are willing to fight. Animals run when they can and fight when they must. And people are no different. But that spirit should only come out when needed. But if it was you out there with the Corlings, he said, or your ma'am, I swear I'd fight like mad before I let them get near you. You understand the difference?
Arlen nodded.
I think so.
Good man, Jeff said, squeezing his shoulder.
Arlen's dreams that night were filled with images of hills that touched the sky and ponds so big you could put a whole town on the surface. He saw yellow sand stretching as far as his eyes could see, and a walled fortress hidden in the trees. But he saw it all between a pair of legs that swayed lazily before his eyes. He looked up and saw his own face turning purple in the noose. He woke with a start, his palate damp with sweat. It was still dark, but there was a faint lightning on the horizon, where the indigo sky held a touch of red. He lit a candle stub and pulled on his overalls, stumbling out to the common room. He found a crust to chew on as he took out the egg basket and milk jugs, putting them by the door. "You're up early," said a voice behind him. He turned, startled, to find Noreen staring at him. Maria was still on her pallet, though she tossed in her sleep.
"The days don't get any longer while you sleep," Arlen said.
Noreen nodded.
"So my husband used to say," she agreed. "Baleses and cutters can't work by candlelight like the squares," he'd say.
"I have a lot to do," Arlen said, peeking through the shutter to see how long he had before he could cross the wards. "The jongleur is supposed to perform at high sun."
"Of course," Noreen agreed. "When I was your age, the jongleur was the most important thing in the world to me, too. I'll help you with your chores."
"You don't have to do that," Arlen said. "Ta says you should rest." Noreen shook her head.
Rest just makes me think of things best left unthought, she said. If I'm to stay with you, I should earn my keep. After chopping wood in the cluster, how hard could it be to slop pigs and plant corn?
Arlen shrugged and handed her the egg basket. With Noreen's help, the chores went by fast. She was a quick learner and no stranger to hard work and heavy lifting. By the time the smell of eggs and bacon wafted from the house, the animals were all fed, the eggs collected, and the cows milked.
"Stop squirming on the bench," Sylvie told Arlen as they ate.
"Young Arlen can't wait to go see the jongleur," Noreen advised.
"Maybe tomorrow," Jeff said, and Arlen's face fell.
"What?"
Arlen cried.
"But..."
"No buts," Jeff said. "A lot of work went undone yesterday, and I promised Celia I'd drop by the cluster in the afternoon to help out."
Arlen pushed his plate away and stomped into his room.
"Let the boy go," Noreen said when he was gone. "Maria and I will help out here."
Maria looked up at the sound of her name, but went back to playing with her food a moment later.
"Arlen had a hard day yesterday," Sylvie said.
She bit her lip.
"We all did. Let the jongleur put a smile on his face. Surely there's nothing that can't wait."
Jeff nodded after a moment. "Arlen," he called. When the boy showed his sullen face, he asked, "How much is old hog charging to see the jongleur?"
"Nothing," Arlen said quickly, not wanting to give his father reason to refuse. "On account of how I helped carry stuff from the messenger's cart."
It wasn't exactly true, and there was a good chance Hogg would be angry that he forgot to tell people. That maybe if he spread word on the walk over, he could bring enough people for his 2 credits at the store to get him in.
"Old Hogg always acts generous right after the messenger comes," Noreen said.
"Ought to, after how he's been fleecing us all winter," Sylvie replied.
"All right, Arlen, you can go," Jeff said. "Meet me in the cluster afterwards."
The walk to Town Square took about 2 hours if you followed the path. Nothing more than a wagon track of hard-packed dirt that Jeff and a few other locals kept clear, it went well out of the way to the bridge at the shallowest part of the brook. Nimble and quick, Arlen could cut the trip in half by skipping across the slick rocks jutting from the water. Today he needed the extra time more than ever, so he could make stops along the way. He raced along the muddy bank at breakneck speed, dodging treacherous roots and scrub with the sure-footed confidence of one who had followed the trail countless times. He popped back out of the woods as he passed the farmhouses on the way, but there was no one to be found. Everyone was either out in the fields or back at the cluster helping out. It was getting close to high sun when he reached Fishing Hole. A few of the fishers had their boats out on the small pond, but Arlen didn't see much point in shouting to them. Otherwise, the hole was deserted, too. He was feeling glum by the time he got to Town Square. Hogg might have seemed nicer than usual yesterday, but Arlen had seen what he was like when someone cost him profit. There was no way he was going to let Arlen see the jongleur for just 2 credits. He'd be lucky if the storekeep didn't take a switch to him. But when he reached the square, he found over 300 people gathered from all over the brook. There were fishers and marshes and boggins and bales, not to mention the town locals, squares, tailors, millers, bakers, and all. None had come from Southwatch, of course. Folks there shunned jongleurs.
"Arlen, my boy," Hogg called, seeing him approach. "I've saved your spot up front, and you'll go home tonight with a sack of salt. Well done."
Arlen looked at him curiously until he saw Reagan standing next to Hogg. The messenger winked at him.
"Thank you," Arlen said when Hogg went off to mark another arrival in his ledger. Daisy and Katrin were selling food and ale for the show.
"People deserve a show," Reagan said with a shrug. "But not without clearing it with your tender, it seems."
He pointed to Kieran, who was deep in conversation with Tender Harrell.
"Don't be selling any of that plague nonsense to my flock," Harrell said, poking Kieran hard in the chest. He was twice the jongleur's weight, and none of it fat.
"Nonsense?" Kieran asked, paling.
"In Milne, the tenders will string up any jongleur that doesn't tell of the plague." I don't care what they do in the free cities, Harold said. These are good people, and they have it hard enough without you telling them their sufferings because they ain't pious enough.
What?
Arlen began, but Kieran broke off, heading to the center of the square.
Best find a seat quick, Reagan advised.
As Hogg promised, Arlen got a seat right in front, in the area usually left for the younger children. The others looked on enviously, and Arlen felt very special. It was rare for anyone to envy him. The jongleur was tall, like all Milnees, dressed in a patchwork of bright colors that looked like they were stolen from the dyer's scrap bin. He had a wispy goatee, the same carrot color as his hair, but the mustache never quite met the beard, and the whole thing looked like it might wash off with a good scrubbing. Everyone, especially the women, talked in wonder about his bright hair and green eyes. As people continued to file in, Kieran paced back and forth, juggling his colored wooden balls and telling jokes, warming to the crowd. When Hogg gave the signal, he took his lute and began to play, singing in a strong, high voice. People clapped along to the songs they didn't know, but whenever he played one that was sung in the brook, the whole crowd sang along, drowning out the jongleur and not seeming to care. Arlen didn't mind. He was singing just as loud as the others. After the music came acrobatics and magic tricks. Along the way, Kieran made a few jests about husbands that had the women shrieking with laughter while the men frowned, and a few about wives that had the men slapping their thighs as the women glared. Finally, the jongleur paused and held up his hands for silence. There was a murmur from the crowd, and parents nudged their youngest children forward, wanting them to hear. Little Jesse Boggan, who was only 5, climbed right into Arlen's lap for a better view. Arlen had given her family a few pups from one of Jeff's dogs a few weeks ago, and now she clung to him whenever he was near. He held her as Kieran began the tale of the return, his high voice dropping into a deep, booming call that carried far into the crowd. "The world was not always as you see it," the jongleur told the children. "No, no. There was a time when humanity lived in balance with the demons. Those early years are called the Age of Ignorance. Does anyone know why?" He looked around the children in front, and several raised their hands. "Because there wasn't any wards?" a girl asked, when Kieran pointed to her. "That's right," the jongleur said, turning a somersault that brought squeals of glee from the children. "The Age of Ignorance was a scary time for us, but there weren't as many demons then, and they couldn't kill everyone. Much like today, humans built what they could during the day, and the demons would tear it down each night. As we struggled to survive," Kieran went on, "we adapted, learning how to hide food and animals from the demons and how to avoid them." He looked around as if in terror, then ran behind one child, cringing. "We lived in holes in the ground so they couldn't find us."
"Like bunnies?" Jesse asked, laughing.
"Just so," Kieran called, putting a twitching finger up behind each ear and hopping about, wriggling his nose. "We lived any way we could," he went on, "until we discovered writing. From there, it wasn't long before we had learned that some writing could hold the Corlings back." "What writing is that?" he asked, cupping an ear. "Wards!" everyone cried in unison. "Correct!" the jongleur congratulated with a flip. "With wards, we could protect ourselves from the Corlings, and we practiced them, getting better and better. More and more wards were discovered until someone learned one that did more than hold the demons back. It hurt them." The children gasped, and Arlen, even though he had heard almost this same performance every year for as long as he could remember, found himself sucking in his breath. But he wouldn't give to know such a ward. "The demons didn't take well to this advancement," Kieran said with a grin. "They were used to us running and hiding, and when we turned and fought, they fought back, hard. Thus began the First Demon War, and the Second Age, the Age of the Deliverer. The Deliverer was a man called upon by the Creator to lead our armies, and with him to lead us, we were winning." He thrust his fist into the air, and the children cheered. It was infectious, and Arlen tickled Jesse with glee.
As our magics and tactics improved, Kieran said, humans began to live longer, and our numbers swelled. Our armies grew larger, even as the number of demons dwindled. There was hope that the Corlings would be vanquished once and for all. The jongleur paused then, and his face took on a serious expression. Then, he said, without warning, the demons stopped coming. Never in the history of the world had a night passed without the Corlings. Now night after night went by with no sign of them, and we were baffled. He scratched his head in mock confusion. Many believed that the demon losses in the war had been too great, and that they'd given up the fight, cowering with fright in the core. He huddled away from the children, hissing like a cat and shaking as if with fear. Some of the children got into the act, growling at him menacingly. The Deliverer, Kieran said, who had seen the demons fight fearlessly every night, doubted this. But as months passed without sign of the creatures, his armies began to fragment. Humanity rejoiced in their victory over the Corlings for years, Kieran went on. He picked up his lute and played a lively tune, dancing about. But as the years passed without the common foe, the brotherhood of men grew strained and then faded. For the first time, we fought against one another. The jongleur's voice turned ominous. As war sparked, the Deliverer was called upon by all sides to lead. But he shouted, "I'll not fight against men while a single demon remains in the core." He turned his back and left the lands as armies marched and all the land fell into chaos. From these great wars arose powerful nations, he said, turning the tune into something uplifting. And mankind spread far and wide, covering the entire world. The age of the Deliverer came to a close, and the age of science began. The age of science, the jongleur said, was our greatest time, but nestled in that greatness was our biggest mistake. Can any here tell me what it was? The older children knew, but Kieran signaled them to hold back and let the young ones answer.
Because we forgot magic, Jim Cutter said, wiping his nose with the back of his hand.
Right you are, Kieran said, snapping his fingers. We learned a great deal about how the world worked, about medicine and machines. But we forgot magic. And worse, we forgot the Corlings. After 3,000 years, no one believed that they had ever even existed. Which is why, he said grimly, we were unprepared when they came back. The demons had multiplied over the centuries as the world forgot them. Then, 300 years ago, they rose from the core one night in massive numbers to take it back. Whole cities were destroyed that first night, as the Corlings celebrated their return. Men fought back, but even the great weapons of the Age of Science were poor defense against the demons. The Age of Science came to a close, and the Age of Destruction took hold. The Second Demon War had begun. In his mind's eye, Arlen saw that night, saw the cities burning as people fled in terror, only to be savaged by the waiting Corlings. He saw men sacrifice themselves to buy time for their families to flee, saw women take claws meant for their children. Most of all, he saw the Corlings dance, cavorting in savage glee as blood ran from their teeth and talons. Kieran moved forward even as the children drew back in fear. The war lasted for years, with people slaughtered at every turn. Without the Deliverer to lead them, they were no match for the Corlings. Overnight, the great nations fell, and the accumulated knowledge of the Age of Science burned as flame demons frolicked. Scholars desperately searched the wreckages of libraries for answers. The old science was no help. But they found salvation at last in stories once considered fantasy and superstition. Men began to draw clumsy symbols in the dirt, preventing the Corlings from approaching. The ancient wards held power still, but the shaking hands that drew them often made mistakes, and they were paid for dearly. Those that survived gathered people to them, protecting them through the long nights. Those men became the first warders, who protect us to this very day. The jongleur pointed to the crowd. So the next time you see a warder, thank him, because you owe him your life. That was a variation on the story Arlen had never heard. Warders. In Tibbetts Brook, everyone learned warding as soon as they were old enough to draw with a stick. Many had poor aptitude for it, but Arlen couldn't imagine anyone not taking the time to learn the basic forbiddings against flame, rock, swamp, water, wind, and wood demons. So now we stay safe within our wards, Kieran said, letting the demons have their pleasures outside. Messengers, he gestured to Reagan, the bravest of all men, travel from city to city for us, bringing news and escorting men and goods. He walked about, his eyes hard as he met the frightened looks of the children. But we are strong, he said. Aren't we? The children nodded, but their eyes were still wide with fear. What? He asked, putting a hand to his ear. Yes, the crowd cried. When the Deliverer comes again, will we be ready? He asked. Will the demons learn to fear us once more? Yes, the crowd roared. They can't hear you, the jongleur shouted. Yes, the people screamed, punching fists in the air, Arlen most of all. Jessie imitated him, punching the air and shrieking as if she were a demon herself. The jongleur bowed, and when the crowd quieted, lifted his lute and led them into another song. As promised, Arlen left town square with a sack of salt. Enough to last weeks, even with Noreen and Maria to feed. It was still unmilled, but Arlen knew his parents would be happy to pound the salt themselves rather than pay Hogg extra for the service. Most would, really, but old Hogg never gave them a choice, milling the salt as soon as it came and tacking on the extra cost. Arlen had a spring in his step as he walked down the road toward the cluster. It wasn't until he passed the tree that Charlie had hung from that Arlen's spirits fell. He thought again about what Reagan had said about fighting Corlings, and what his father had said about prudence. He thought his father probably had the right of it. Hide when you can, and fight when you must. Even Reagan seemed to agree with that philosophy. But Arlen couldn't shake the feeling that hiding hurt people too, in ways they couldn't see. He met his father in the cluster and earned a clap on the back when he showed his prize. He spent the rest of the afternoon running to and fro, helping rebuild. Already, another house was repaired and would be warded by nightfall. In a few more weeks, the cluster would be fully rebuilt, and that was in everyone's interest if they wanted enough wood to last the winter. I promised Celia I'd throw in here for the next few days, Jeff said as they packed the cart that afternoon. You'll be the man of the farm while I'm gone. You'll have to check the ward posts and weed the fields. I saw you show Noreen your chores this morning. She can handle the yard, and Maria can help your mother inside. All right, Arlen said. Weeding the fields and checking the posts was hard work, but the trust made him proud. I'm counting on you, Arlen, Jeff said. I won't let you down, Arlen promised. The next few days passed with little event. Sylvie still cried at times, but there was work to do, and she never once complained of the additional mouths to feed. Noreen took to caring for the animals naturally, and even Maria began to come out of her shell a bit, helping with the sweeping and cooking, working the loom after supper. Soon she was taking turns with Noreen in the yard. Both women seemed determined to do their share, though their faces, too, grew pained and wistful whenever there was a lull in the work. Arlen's hands blistered from pulling weeds, and his back and shoulders ached at the end of each day, but he didn't complain. The only one of his new responsibilities he enjoyed was working on the ward posts. Arlen had always loved warding, mastering the basic defensive symbols before most children began learning at all, and more complex ward nets soon after. Jeff didn't even check his work anymore. Arlen's hand was steadier than his father's. Warding wasn't the same as attacking a demon with a spear, but it was fighting in its own way. Jeff arrived at dusk each day, and Sylvie had water from the well waiting for him to wash off. Arlen helped Noreen and Maria lock up the animals, and then they had supper. On the fifth day, a wind kicked up in the late afternoon that sent dust whirls dancing in the yard and had the barn door banging. Arlen could smell rain coming, and the darkening sky confirmed it. He hoped Jeff saw the signs, too, and came back early, or stayed on in the cluster. Dark clouds meant an early dusk, and early dusk sometimes meant callings before full sunset. Arlen abandoned the fields and began to help the women herd the spooked animals back into the barn. Sylvie was out as well, battening down the cellar doors and making sure the ward posts around the day pens were lashed tight. There was little time to spare when Jeff's cart came into sight. The sky was darkening quickly, and already there was no direct sun. Callings could rise at any moment. "No time to unhitch the cart," Jeff called, cracking the whip to drive Missy faster toward the barn. "We'll do it in the morning. Everyone in the house, now!" Sylvie and the other women complied, heading inside. "We can do it if we hurry," Arlen yelled over the roar of the wind as he ran after his father. Missy would be in foul spirits for days if she spent the night harnessed. Jeff shook his head. "It's too dark already. A night hitched won't kill her." "Lock me in the barn, then," Arlen said. "I'll unhitch her and wait out the storm with the animals." "Do as you're told, Arlen," Jeff shouted. He leapt from the cart and grabbed the boy by the arm, half-dragging him out of the barn. The two of them pulled the door shut, and through the bars, lightning split the sky. The boards painted on the barn doors were illuminated for a moment, a reminder of what was to come. The air was pregnant with the promise of rain. They ran for the house, scanning the way before them for the mist that would herald the rising. For the moment, the way was clear. Maria held the door open, and they darted inside, just as the first fat drops of rain stirred the dust of the yard. Maria was pulling the door closed when a howl sounded from the yard. Everyone froze.
"The dog!" Maria cried, covering her mouth. "I left him tied to the fence!"
"Leave him," Jeff said. "Close the door."
"What?"
Arlen cried, incredulous. He whirled to face his father.
"The way is still clear," Maria cried, and darted out of the house. "Maria, no," Sylvie cried, running out after her.
Arlen, too, ran for the door, but not before Jeff grabbed the shoulder straps of his overalls and yanked him backward. "Stay inside," he ordered, moving to the door. Arlen stumbled back a moment, then ran forward again. Jeff and Noreen were out on the porch, but stayed within the line of the outer wards. By the time Arlen reached the porch, the dog was running past him into the house, the rope still trailing from its neck. Out in the yard, wind howled, turning the drops of rain into stinging insects. He saw Maria and his mother running back toward the house just as the demons began to rise. As always, flame demons came first, their misty forms seeping from the ground. The smallest of callings, they crouched on all fours as they coalesced, barely 18 inches tall at the shoulder. Their eyes, nostrils, and mouths glowed with a smoky light.
"Run, Sylvie!" Jeff screamed. "Run!"
It seemed that they would make it, but then Maria stumbled and went down. Sylvie turned to help her, and in that moment, the first calling solidified. Arlen moved to run to his mother, but Noreen's hand clamped hard on his arm, holding him fast.
"Don't be stupid," the woman hissed.
"Get up," Sylvie demanded, yanking Maria's arm.
"My ankle," Maria cried. "I can't. Go on without me."
"Like night I will," Sylvie growled.
"Jeff," she called, "help us."
By then, callings were forming all over the yard. Jeff stood frozen as they took note of the women and shrieked with pleasure, darting toward them.
"Let go,"
Arlen growled, stomping hard on Noreen's foot. She howled, and Arlen yanked his arm free. He grabbed the nearest weapon he could find, a wooden milk bucket, and ran out into the yard. "Arlen, no!" Jeff cried, but Arlen was done listening to him. A flame demon, no bigger than a large cat, leapt atop Sylvie's back, and she screamed as talons raked deep lines in her flesh, leaving the back of her dress a bloody tatter. From its perch, the corling spat fire into Maria's face. The woman shrieked as her skin melted and her hair ignited. Arlen was there an instant later, swinging the bucket with all his strength. It broke apart as it struck, but the demon was knocked from his mother's back. She stumbled, but Arlen was there to support her. More flame demons closed in on them, even as wind demons began to stretch their wings, and a dozen yards off, a rock demon began to take form. Sylvie groaned, but she got to her feet. Arlen pulled her away from Maria and her agonized wails, but the way back to the house was blocked by flame demons. The rock demon caught sight of them too and charged. A few wind demons, preparing to take off, got in the massive beast's way, and its talons swept them aside as easily as a scythe cut through corn stalks. They tumbled broken through the air, and flame demons set on them, tearing them to pieces. It was only a moment's distraction, but Arlen took it, pulling his mother away from the house. The barn was blocked as well, but the path to the day pen was still clear, if they could keep ahead of the Corlings. Sylvie was screaming, not of fear or pain, Arlen didn't know, but she stumbled along, keeping pace even in her wide skirts. As he broke into a run, so too did the flame demons half surrounding them. The rain began to fall harder, and the wind howled. Lightning split the sky, illuminating their pursuers and the day pen, so close yet still so far. The dust of the yard was slick with the growing wet, but fear granted them agility, and they kept their feet under them. The rock demon's footfalls were as loud as the thunder as it charged, growing ever closer, making the ground shake with its stride. Arlen skidded to a stop at the pens and fumbled with the latch. The flame demons caught up in that split second, coming in range to use their deadliest weapon. They spat flame, and Arlen and his mother were struck. The blast was weakened by distance, but still he felt his clothes ignite and smelled burning hair. A flare of pain washed over him, but he ignored it, finally getting the gate to the pen open. He had started to take his mother inside when another flame demon leapt on her, claws digging deep into her chest. With a yank, Arlen pulled her into the pen. As they crossed the wards, Sylvie passed through easily, but magic flared and the Corling was thrown back. Its claws, hooked deep in her, came free in a spray of blood and flesh. Their clothes were still burning. Wrapping Sylvie in his arms, Arlen threw them both to the ground, taking the brunt of the impact himself, and then rolled them into the mud, extinguishing the flames. There was no chance to close the gate. The demons ringed the pen now, pounding at the ward net, sending flares of magic skittering along the web of wards. But the gate didn't really matter, nor did the fence. So long as the ward posts were intact, they were safe from the Corlings. But not from the weather. The rain became a cold pour, whipping at them in cutting sheets. Sylvie couldn't rise again after the fall. Blood and mud caked her, and Arlen didn't know if she could survive her wounds and the rain together. He stumbled over to the slop trough and kicked it over, sloshing the unfinished remnants of the pig's dinner to rot in the mud. Arlen could see the rock demon pounding at the ward net, but the magic held, and the demon couldn't pass. Between the flashes of lightning and the spurts of demon flame, he caught sight of Maria, buried under a swarm of flame demons, each tearing off a piece and dancing away to feast. The rock demon gave up a moment later, stopping over and grabbing Maria by the leg in a massive talon the way a cruel man might grab a cat. Flame demons scattered as the rock demon swung the woman into the air. She let out a hoarse gasp, and Arlen was horrified to discover that she was still alive. He screamed and considered trying to dart from the ward net to get her. But then the demon brought her crashing down to the ground with a sickening crunch. Arlen turned away before the creature could begin to eat, his tears washed away by the pouring rain. Dragging the trough to Sylvie, he tore the lining from her skirt and let it soak in the rain.
He brushed the mud from her cuts as best as he could, and wadded more lining into them. It was hardly clean, but cleaner than pig mud. She was shivering, so he lay against her for warmth, and pulled the stinking trough over them as a shield from the downpour and the sight of the leering demons. There was one more flash of lightning as he lowered the wood. The last thing he saw was his father, still standing frozen on the porch. "If it was you out there, or your ma'am," Arlen remembered him saying. But for all his promises, it seemed that nothing could make Jeff Bales fight. The night passed with interminable slowness. There was no hope of sleep. Raindrops drummed a steady beat on the trough, spattering them with the remains of the slop that clung to the inside. The mud they lay in was cold and stank of pig droppings. Sylvie shivered in her delirium, and Arlen clutched her tightly, willing what little heat he had into her. His own hands and feet were numb. Despair crept over him, and he wept into his mother's shoulder. But she groaned and patted his hand, and that simple instinctive gesture pulled him free of the terror and disillusionment and pain. He'd fought a demon and lived. He stood in a yard full of them and survived. Corlings might be immortal, but they could be outmaneuvered. They could be outsped. And as the rock demon had shown when it swept the other Corling out of the way, they could be hurt. But what difference did it make in a world where men like Jeff wouldn't stand up to the Corlings, not even for their own families? What hope did any of them have? He stared at the blackness around him for hours, but in his mind's eye all he saw was his father's face, staring at them from the safety of the wards. The rain tapered off before dawn. Arlen used the break in the weather as a chance to lift the trough, but he immediately regretted it as the collected heat the wood had stored was lost. He pulled it down again, but stole peaks until the sky began to brighten. Most of the Corlings had faded away by the time it was light enough to see, but a few stragglers remained as the sky went from indigo to lavender. He lifted the trough and clambered to his feet, trying vainly to brush off the slime and muck that clung to him. His arm was stiff and stung when he flexed it. He looked down and saw that the skin was bright red where the fire spit had struck. The night in the mud did one good thing, he thought, knowing his and his mother's burns would have been far worse had they not been packed in the cold muck all night. As the last flame demons in the yard began to turn insubstantial, Arlen strode from the pen, heading for the barn. "Arlen, no!" a cry came from the porch. Arlen looked up and saw Jeff there, wrapped in a blanket, keeping watch from the safety of the porch wards. "It's not full dawn yet, wait!" Arlen ignored him, walking to the barn and opening the doors. Missy looked thoroughly unhappy, still hitched to the cart, but she'd make it to town square. A hand grabbed his arm as he led the horse out. "Are you trying to get yourself killed?" Jeff demanded. "You mind me, boy." Arlen tore his arm away, refusing to look his father in the eye. "Ma'am needs to see Colleen Trigg," he said. "She's alive?" Jeff asked incredulously, his head snapping over to where the woman lay in the mud. "No thanks to you," Arlen said. "I'm taking her to town square." "We're taking her," Jeff corrected, rushing over to lift his wife and carry her to the cart. Leaving Noreen to tend the animals and seek out poor Maria's remains, they headed off down the road to town. Sylvie was bathed in sweat, and while her burns seemed no worse than Arlen's, the deep lines the flame demon's talons had dug still oozed blood, the flesh an ugly, swollen red. "Arlen, I..." Jeff began as they rode, reaching a shaking hand toward his son. Arlen drew back, looking away, and Jeff recoiled as if burned. Arlen knew his father was ashamed. It was just as Reagan had said. Maybe Jeff even hated himself, as Charlie had. Still, Marlon could find no sympathy. His mother had paid the price for Jeff's cowardice. They rode the rest of the way in silence. Colleen Trigg's two-story house in Town Square was one of the largest in the Brook, and filled with beds. In addition to her family upstairs, Colleen always had at least one person in the sick beds on the ground floor. Colleen was a short woman with a large nose and no chin. She wasn't yet 30, but 6 children had made her thick around the middle. Her clothes always smelled of burnt weeds, and her cures usually involved some type of foul-tasting tea. The people of Tibbetts Brook made fun of that tea, but every one of them drank it gratefully when they took a chill. The herb gatherer took one look at Sylvie, and had Arlen and his father bring her right inside. She asked no questions, which was just as well, as neither Arlen nor Jeff knew what they would say if she did. As she cut at each wound, squeezing out a sickly brown pus, the air filled with a rotten stench. She cleaned the drained wounds with water and ground herbs, then sewed them shut. Jeff turned green and brought his hand to his mouth suddenly.
"Out of here with that," Colleen barked, sending Jeff from the room with a pointed finger.
As Jeff scurried out of the house, she looked to Arlen.
"You too?" she demanded.
Arlen shook his head. Colleen stared at him a moment, then nodded in approval.
"You're braver than your father," she said. "Fetch the mortar and pestle. I'm going to teach you to make a bomb for Burns."
Never taking her eyes from her work, Colleen talked Arlen through the countless jars and pouches in her pharmacy, directing him to each ingredient and explaining how to mix them. She kept to her grisly work as Arlen applied the bomb to his mother's burns. Finally, when Sylvie's wounds were all tended, she turned to inspect Arlen. He protested at first, but the bomb did its work, and only as the coolness spread along his arms did he realize how much his burns had stung.
"Will she be all right?" Arlen asked, looking at his mother.
She seemed to be breathing normally, but the flesh around her wounds was an ugly color, and that stench of rot was still thick in the air.
"I don't know," Colleen said. She wasn't one to honey her words. "I've never seen anyone with wounds so severe. Usually if the Corlings get that close..."
"They kill you," Jeff said from the doorway. "They would have killed Sylvie, too, if not for Arlen." He stepped into the room, his eyes down.
"Arlen taught me something last night, Colleen," Jeff said. "He taught me fear is our enemy, more than the Corlings ever were."
Jeff put his hands on his son's shoulders and looked into his eyes.
"I won't fail you again," he promised.
Arlen nodded and looked away.
He wanted to believe it was so, but his thoughts kept returning to the sight of his father on the porch, frozen with terror.
Jeff went over to Sylvie, grabbing her clammy hand in his own. She was still sweating and thrashed in her drugged sleep now and then.
"Will she die?" Jeff asked.
The herb gatherer blew out a long breath.
"I'm a fair hand at setting bones," she said, "and delivering children. I can chase a fever away and ward a chill. I can even cleanse a demon wound if it's still fresh."
She shook her head.
"But this is demon fever. I've given her herbs to dull the pain and help her sleep, but you'll need a better gatherer than I to brew a cure."
"Who else is there?" Jeff asked.
"You're all the Brook has."
"The woman who taught me," Colleen said. "Old May Freeman. She lives on the outskirts of Sunny Pasture, 2 days from here. If anyone can cure it, she can. But you'd best hurry. The fever will spread quickly, and if you take too long, even old May won't be able to help you." "How do we find her?" Jeff demanded.
"You can't really get lost," Colleen said. "There's only the one road. Just don't turn at the fork where it goes through the woods unless you want to spend weeks on the road to Milne. That messenger left for the pasture a few hours ago, but he had some stops in the Brook first. If you hurry, you might catch him. Messengers carry their own wards with them. If you find him, you'll be able to keep moving right until dusk instead of stopping for succor. The messenger could cut your trip in twain.
We'll find him, Jeff said. Whatever it takes.
His voice took on a determined edge, and Arlen began to hope. A strange sense of longing pulled at Arlen as he watched Tibbetts Brook recede into the distance from the back of the cart. For the first time, he was going to be more than a day's travel from home. He was going to see another town. A week ago, an adventure like that was his greatest dream. But now all he dreamed was that things could go back to the way they were. Back when the farm was safe. Back when his mother was well. Back when he didn't know his father was a coward. Colleen had promised to send one of her boys up to the farm to let Noreen know that they would likely be gone a week or more, and to help tend the animals and check the wards while they were away. The neighbors would throw in, but Noreen's loss was too raw for her to face the nights alone. The herb gatherer had also given them a crude map, carefully rolled and slipped into a protective hide tube. Paper was a rarity in the brook, and not given away lightly. Arlen was fascinated by the map and studied it for hours, even though he couldn't read the few words labeling the places. Neither Arlen nor his father had letters. The map marked the way to Sunny Pasture and what lay along the road, but the distances were vague. There were farms marked along the way where they could beg succor, but there was no way to tell how far apart they were. His mother slept fitfully, sodden with sweat. Sometimes she spoke or cried out, but her words made little sense. Arlen daubed her with wet cloth and made her drink the sharp tea as the herb gatherer had instructed him, but it seemed to do little good. Late in the afternoon, they approached the house of Harl Tanner, a farmer who lived on the outskirts of the brook. Harl's farm was only a couple of hours past the cluster by the woods, but by the time Arlen and his father had gotten underway, it was mid-afternoon. Arlen remembered seeing Harl and his three daughters at the summer solstice festival each year, though they'd been absent since the Corlings had taken Harl's wife 2 summers past. Harl had become a recluse, and his daughters with him. Even the tragedy in the cluster hadn't brought them out. 3/4 of the tanner fields were blackened and scorched. Only those closest to the house were warded and sown. A gaunt milking cow chewed cud in the muddy yard, and ribs showed clearly on the goat tied up with a chicken coop. The tanner's home was a single story of piled stones, held together with packed mud and clay. The larger stones were painted with faded wards. Marlin thought them clumsy, but they had lasted thus far, it seemed. The roof was uneven, with short, squat ward posts poking up through the rotting thatch. One side of the house connected to the small barn, its windows boarded and the door half off its hinges. Across the yard was the big barn, looking even worse. The wards might hold, but it looked ready to collapse on its own.
"I've never seen Harl's place before," Jeff said.
"Me neither," Marlin lied.
Few people apart from messengers had reason to head up the road past the cluster by the woods, and those who lived up that way were sources of great speculation in Town Square. Arlen had snuck off to see Crazy Man Tanner's farm more than once. It was the farthest he had ever been from home. Getting back before dusk had meant hours of running as fast as he could. One time, a few months before, he almost didn't make it. He'd been trying to catch a glimpse of Harl's eldest daughter, Elaine. The other boys said she had the biggest boobies in the brook, and he wanted to see for himself. He waited one day and saw her come running out of the house crying. She was beautiful in her sadness, and Arlen had wanted to go comfort her, even though she was 8 summers older than him. He hadn't been so bold, but he'd watched her longer than was wise, and almost paid a heavy price for it when the sun began to set. A mangy dog began barking as they approached the farm, and a young girl came out onto the porch, watching them with sad eyes.
"We might have to succor here," Jeff said.
"It's still hours till dark," Arlen said, shaking his head. "If we don't catch Reagan by then, the map says there's another farm up by where the road forks to the Free Cities."
Jeff peered over Arlen's shoulder at the map. "That's a long way," he said.
"Ma'am can't wait," Arlen said.
We won't make it all the way today, but every hour is an hour closer to her cure.
Jeff looked back at Sylvie, bathed in sweat, then up at the sun, and nodded. They waved at the girl on the porch, but didn't stop.